Welcome back to Adventures in Theater History. At the end of our last episode, we left Fanny Kemble, now Mrs. Pierce Butler, in the early days of her marriage in 1834. It was almost immediately evident to her, and to her former friends in the theater world, and to everyone in both the Kemble and the Butler families, that things in this marriage were not going well. Not at all. As we mentioned previously, one of Fanny's first discoveries was the source of the wealth of the family she had married into. The Butlers, it turned out, not only had large holdings in Philadelphia real estate, but possessed large plantations on the sea islands of Georgia. Nearly 1,000 enslaved people were laboring every day to clothe and feed and enrich her, she realized to her horror. It rather startles our modern imagination that she could not have known any of this before agreeing to become a butler, but she repeatedly states in her letters and memoirs that she did not, and I suppose we must take her at her word. 19th century people could be surprisingly squeamish about discussing certain topics. And her husband, Pierce Butler, could be amazingly vague and evasive when it came to things he considered his business. For someone like Fanny, who was in complete accord with parliamentary legislation to end slavery in the British Empire, and who already was in close friendship with American abolitionists such as the Boston Unitarian minister William Channing, it was a deeply disturbing revelation. Rather as if today an ardent environmentalist discovered that her new husband owned open-pit coal mines and logging companies. It also turned out that Fanny and Pierce Butler had completely different ideas about what marriage even was. Fanny's own parents' marriage had difficulties over the years, but their relationship was certainly not based on stern patriarchy. Many years afterwards, Pierce Butler himself would complain that Fanny had made extraordinary statements soon after their wedding. Quote, "She held that marriage should be a companionship on equal terms, a partnership in which, if both partners agree, it is well, but if they do not, neither is bound to yield." And to Pierce's mind, that was simply a ridiculous proposition. What utter nonsense! A man controlled his household in all matters, and it was the wife's duty to support him in all his decisions. And to be fair, in that era, he would not have been wrong in believing that almost every other man in America would take his side about that. Pierce, who had been such a mild-mannered and doting suitor while courting Fanny, soon revealed that he had every intention of being an absolute ruler in his own home. Quarrels between the young couple were often about Fanny's former associations in the theater world. For instance, when she wanted to invite to dinner the English actors Charles Matthews and Mrs. Matthews, who was better known in her day as Madame Vestris, who were great friends of her parents and were then touring America, Pierce icily said that now that she was in a higher social situation than mere actors, why would she ever want to associate with them again? So, the two Matthews did not come over to dine, and indeed Fanny did not generally associate with other performers in Philadelphia or even attend the city's theater for many years. Furthermore, Pierce was completely against her publishing her Journal of a Young Actress, the manuscript she had faithfully kept as per her signed contract with a London publisher about the 2 years she had spent touring America with her father, Charles Kemble. Fanny's book was full of backstage gossip, personal observations about American politics, fashions, and customs, bits of her own poetry, and many long lyrical passages about nature and local scenery. and even about the American landscape, sometimes Fanny proved to be annoyingly and consistently Anglo-centric. She criticized the color of American trees in the autumn as being too garish and showy compared to those of her homeland. I mean, come on. But it was her breezy remarks about the other members of Philadelphia and New York society that really appalled Pierce. Even with all the names carefully replaced with dashes and dots, it would mean social death if they were published, he felt. He tried to buy out the contract, but the publisher, sensing he had a potential best-selling book here, refused. So instead, Pierce insisted on Fanny letting him strike out offensive passages. And you can imagine how she felt about that. When Fanny also tried to write a protest against slavery and attach it at the end of the book, well, Pierce absolutely forbid it. If that got out, it was likely that Philadelphia anti-abolitionist mobs would come and burn down their house. After a protracted argument, Fanny fled the house, resolving to find a way to get back to England alone. After wandering the streets of Philadelphia for hours, the reality struck her that she had no financial resources anymore, that were not under her husband's control anyway, so she could go nowhere. Defeated, she quietly came back to the Butler family mansion on the corner of 8th and Chestnut and shut herself in her room for a long time. As far as the issue of slavery went, Fanny did at least agree not to become an active abolitionist, a political stance which was regarded as a radical extremist position by most Americans of her day. Her name never appeared on the rolls of the Philadelphia Anti-Slavery Society, nor did she join any other abolitionist group. She was never a public face of the movement like Lucretia Mott or Angelina Grimke. She certainly never assisted any of Philadelphia's African-American population or its Quakers in running the Underground Railroad, and she never helped escaping slaves find their way to freedom. It would have been astounding if she did, because the plain fact was that among Philadelphia's upper crust, where the Butlers were, not a few of them also had fortunes that were originally based on the slave trade, or were presently involved in banking and insurance companies that dealt in accounts and loans that provided slavery's financial foundation throughout America. In addition, Fanny seems to have believed, at least at first, the widely held story that the Butler family was somehow different, that their plantations were well managed and their slaves treated humanely, and that they took paternalistic care of their people and never allowed slave families to be separated and sent them to church on Sundays. You know, the good type of slave owners. But almost every day that her new married life continued, Fanny learned more and more about the truth of the source of the Butler family's fortunes and about the years of secretiveness, curdled resentment, and intrigue amongst members of the Butler family. It all went back to the first Pierce Butler, who was born in 1744, an emigrant from a large and powerful Anglo-Irish clan. As a younger son, he had no hope of an inheritance, so like many others of his class and era, he set off into the world to wrest a fortune from wherever he could in the burgeoning British Empire. He became an officer in the army, and his regiment was stationed in the colony of South Carolina. There, Butler wooed and married a wealthy heiress of the Middleton family. Resigning his British commission in 1773, Butler became an ardent American patriot during the Revolution, fighting bravely in the cause of independence, attaining the rank of general, and nearly losing his life and his wife's estates many times. In the post-war era, he became prominent in South Carolina politics and was a delegate from the state of South Carolina to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. During the proceedings, he was a fierce advocate for the interests of the white slaveholders and the planter elite. It was due to this Pierce Butler that the infamous Three-Fifths Clause was inserted into the U.S. Constitution. He also introduced Article 4, Section 2, which ensured slaveholders' rights to recover escaped slaves in free states. He signed the document upon its completion and signed it with pride. He was chosen as a senator from South Carolina multiple times, though he eventually lost popular support in the state due to his erratic and idiosyncratic switching of political allegiances, rather like his friend Aaron Burr, actually. Burr, by the way, would one day take refuge on Butler's southern estates as he fled the North after killing Alexander Hamilton in their famous duel. In 1790, after the death of his wife, General Butler sold off her land in South Carolina and had, rather illegally, transferred all the enslaved persons from her estate and moved them to two huge new plantations on the Georgia Sea Islands, St. Simon's Island and what soon became known as Butler Island, near the towns of Darien and Brunswick, Georgia. He set them to work, growing rice and, most especially, long-fiber cotton. Now, this prime crop was in huge demand in Britain's cotton mills at the time, and Butler raked in the money year after year. By 1805, he had settled himself back in Philadelphia, leaving his southern plantations in the care of managers and overseers. Like many former members of the U.S. Congress who had served during the 1790s, he found he missed the amenities of Philadelphia, and most especially, he wanted to get involved where the real money was to be made, banking. Soon he was a director of the First Bank of the United States and was one of the wealthiest men in America. He built a showy and impressive mansion on the northeast corner of 8th and Chestnut Streets and purchased a 300-acre property near Germantown, northwest of Philadelphia, where he built a country estate called Butler Place. Although he was an ardent proponent of liberty and democracy, at least for white property owners such as himself, within his own family, General Butler was famously controlling and tyrannical. He disinherited his only surviving son, who had moved to France in order to escape his awful father. In his will, he left his money just to his three daughters. Only the oldest daughter had married to a kindly and mild-mannered Philadelphia physician, Dr. James Meese. The Meeses had two sons, but before he died in 1822, the family patriarch specified in his will that they would have to change their last name to Butler if they ever wanted to inherit his money. Which is exactly what Pierce Meese Butler and his brother John had done shortly before Fanny Kemble had arrived on the scene in 1832. And eventually, into this family, not knowing any of its alarming history, she had cast her lot. In fact, when she and Pierce were married at Philadelphia's Christ Church on 2nd Street in June of 1834, the grave of his grandfather was in the churchyard outside, only a few steps away. He's one of several founding fathers buried there, in fact, but his legacy was toxic in so many ways. The Philadelphia diarist Sidney Fisher noted that, to his mind, every woman who had ever been a member of the Butler family had eventually become miserable. Fanny was to be the next of their victims. Soon, she and her new husband had moved out to make their home at the family's country estate, Butler Place, in Germantown. While Pierce attended lazily to his supposed law practice back in Philadelphia, Fanny attempted to spread local goodwill by being a typical Lady Bountiful of the manor. On the 4th of July, she sponsored a holiday feast for her neighbors with plenty of food and strong drink spread out on the lawn, not realizing that most of the population of Germantown back then were Quakers and that they neither drank spirits nor took days off from work, not even for America's Independence Day. Fanny became pregnant, and her daughter, Sarah, was born in May of 1835. The child was healthy and beautiful, but it had been a difficult labor for Fanny. To lose extra weight, Fanny was soon out determinedly riding horses again for exercise, scandalizing Philadelphia by insisting on wearing male riding attire with Turkish trousers instead of skirts. A portrait shows Fanny looking thin again, but also distant and somewhat drawn. The vivacity of previous images made of her when she was an actress had seemingly drained away. Perhaps the wan look she exhibits in the portrait was because of the public reaction to the recent publication of her book, Journal of a Young Actress. As the publishers had supposed, the book had become an immediate bestseller on both sides of the Atlantic. Even the future Queen Victoria had read it. But young Vicky's opinion of it, it turned out, was about the same as everybody else's, that though it was highly entertaining and vividly written, there was much in it that was just scandalous, silly, and embarrassing to Fanny. American journalists, for their part, certainly didn't like it that at one point she compared them to swarming insects. Even her friend, the American novelist Elizabeth Sedgwick, allowed that the book lacked tact, judgment, and good sense. Fanny tried to ignore the reviews and busied herself with the tasks of motherhood. Ominously, Pierce began to find excuses to stay in town during the week and often didn't come back to Germantown at all at night. Arguments between the young couple got worse. Fanny began to suspect that he was already unfaithful to her, and seizing an opportunity when she heard that her father was ill, she took little Sarah and rushed back home to England. As Fanny left these shores for the first time in about 4 years, it was clear that she had gone through the first full cycle of American celebrity, from initial enchantment and adulation to disenchantment, public scorn, and then ridicule. As she boarded the packet to England, the New York Mirror wrote, quote, "What with her playing, scribbling, writing, and marrying, she has been as much talked about as a comet. From the silent manner of her departure, we fear there is a settled coolness between her and our Republican public." Well, the story of her marriage keeps getting worse from there. I'm sorry, I don't have time to cover every aspect of Fanny Kemble's life during her long exile from the theater. But after all, that's not strictly our mission here. And I'm happy to report that her life story has been detailed by many great writers and historians. And if you want to know more, I direct you to the blog entries and bibliographies that we always post about our subjects on our website, AITHpodcast.com. That's AITH for Adventures in Theater History, podcast.com. Suffice it to say that Fanny and Pierce had some moments of reconciliation, as it were, and during one of those, she returned to Philadelphia, and the couple had their second daughter, also named Frances Anne. The baby was born, in fact, on the exact same date as her sister had been, in May of 1838, and because of her imminent confinement, and perhaps to the Butler family's relief, Fanny could not join in the famous Pennsylvania Hall meeting of the Anti-Slavery Society in Philadelphia that month, and the subsequent riot and attack on the building by violent anti-abolition mobs. As her husband had predicted, they burned the place down, though the zeal of the undaunted abolitionist continued to burn, too. That summer, with the new baby in tow, the entire family finally went off together to inspect their property in Georgia. Upon the death of their last surviving aunt, Pierce and his brother John had finally received their full inheritance and their rights to the Butler plantations. Fanny had long begged Pierce that she at least be allowed to see the place, and her husband at long last acquiesced. Throughout the arduous journey, and despite the multitude of motherly and wifely chores she had to attend to, Fanny, being Fanny, kept a meticulous journal detailing everything she saw and experienced. Upon their arrival, it seemed like almost the entire population of the Butler slaves had turned out to greet the arriving young master and his family, effusively and happily, which is not perhaps what you might expect. But some historians have pointed out that since the worst thing that could happen to a long-established community of enslaved people was the death or the bankruptcy of their owners and everybody being sold off and fed into the terrifying and remorseless spread of American slavery. So Pierce Butler actually showing up with a young and healthy-looking wife and beautiful young children was a welcome sign of stability and continuity in their lives, that their own families perhaps did not face the danger of being broken up. Now, that may all be true, but admittedly, we don't have much direct testimony or evidence from their point of view about the event. Be that as it may, we do know that Fanny could immediately see that the Butler plantation was not, contrary to its reputation, either a well-run or a beneficent place. The supposed big house where she and her family were installed proved to be a much smaller and more primitive affair than she had expected, with just a few rooms and a detached dirt floor kitchen. The enslaved people, for their part, were disgracefully ill-housed, ill-fed, and ill-treated. For example, Fanny noted in painful detail all the gynecological issues and complications from frequent childbirth most of the enslaved women faced, even as they were sent daily into the fields, along with their small children. It was almost overwhelming. But during her stay, she did what she could to at least ameliorate the misery, establishing an infirmary, paying small wages to her personal servants, and leading hygiene campaigns among the children. She even furtively taught one boy the alphabet, which she knew was illegal and dangerous to both of them. About the larger issue of the injustice of slavery that she now saw firsthand, she felt increasing indignation, but felt she could do little for the moment. Reading over the journal today, Fanny's description of the people of the islands with their highly Africanized Gullah dialect is done with many words that are more than a bit jarring to modern sensibilities, though clearly she tries to be sympathetic. But it is her description of the white people and their supposedly civilized and civilizing mastery for which she reserves her most pointed and withering prose. Her own husband comes in for the worst of it. Every day, Pierce Butler seemed to shrink in her eyes as the magnitude of his moral hypocrisy and cruelty became more evident to her. Once again, as in our last episode, I am deeply honored by having the actress Jessica Bedford to voice the words of Fanny Kemble from her journals and letters.
Mr. Butler was called out to listen to a complaint of overwork from a gang of pregnant women. I did not stay to listen to the details of their petition, for I am unable to command myself on such occasions. And Mr. Butler seems positively degraded in my eyes as he stood enforcing upon these women the necessity of their fulfilling their appointed tasks.
And another thing that deeply worried Fanny was watching the bad moral influence upon her 3-year-old daughter, Sarah. This little blonde girl was petted and made much of wherever she went, usually surrounded by admiring playmates who were her own age, but who were already keenly aware of the yawning difference in their social rank.
I was observing her today among her worshippers, for they follow her as such, and saw, with dismay, the universal eagerness with which they sprang to obey her little gestures of command. Think of learning to rule despotically your fellow creatures before the first lesson of self-government has been well spelled over. It makes me tremble. But I shall find a remedy, or remove myself and the children from this misery and ruin.
But what, in her current situation, could she actually do? For the 4 years of her life that had preceded her marriage, when Fanny was a successful actress, she had literally coined money. She could not help remembering that fact. And never until this moment, she wrote to herself in her journal, did it really strike her what exactly it meant that she had so gladly agreed to give up her own independence forever for a maintenance by the unpaid labor of slaves. She never could be the same person after this. And upon the family's return to Philadelphia later that year, she entered into one of the most difficult periods of her life. Her marriage was effectively over, and she banished Pierce from her bed. Her anti-slavery journal was privately circulated in manuscript form amongst her abolitionist friends, so people she cared about at least knew what she thought now. But nonetheless, she sank into a depression. Pierce, for his part, began a new series of affairs with other women. He even fought an actual duel down in Delaware with a man named Schott, S-C-H-O-T-T, who publicly accused Pierce of having an open affair with Mrs. Schott. It was the standard pistols at dawn encounter, and both men missed their opponents. So, said the local wags, fortunately Schott did not get pierced by his wife's seducer, but unfortunately neither did Pierce get Schott. Back at home, the butlers' marital battle went on for years, and the situation was not helped by the fact that Pierce's financial mismanagement of his enormous fortune had forced the family to vacate and rent out Butler Place. For a long period, the family was living in a tawdry boarding house on Washington Square in Philadelphia, but it wasn't until November of 1843 that Fanny asked him for a formal separation. This meant losing access to her children, which was agonizing. Though she was occasionally allowed to see little Sarah and little Fan, Pierce was always finding ways to separate them from their mother and control her over access to them. In 1845, he finally announced that he would no longer allow her to raise the children, and Fanny was forced to give up the fight. Marriage laws of the day gave the husband complete control over the children until they reached the age of 21. Maddeningly, he also had complete control over her financially. Legally, any money she earned belonged to him, and Pierce expressly forbade her from going on the stage again, or even associating with theater people or certain others of her friends that he disapproved of, like the Sedgwicks. With no bearable life left in America, Fanny sailed again for England in October of 1845. She wrote to a friend disconsolately that he has sent me penniless, as well as husbandless and childless, home. The famous dictum of the writer F. Scott Fitzgerald that there are no second acts in American lives has been disproven so many times that it almost seems ridiculous to quote it anymore. But since the theatrical metaphor is particularly apt for our subject, in this case, perhaps we can trot it out for yet another refutation. We do find a second act in Fanny Kemble's, well, Anglo-American life. After casting aside what she felt was the wretched practice of acting on the stage early in her life, she found that now she was able to return to the dramatic arts to support herself. It was a lucrative source of income after many years of deprivation, and one that was not controlled by her husband. In England, she found her feet again. Her mother had passed away, and her father, Charles Kemble, was now retired from the stage and was living on the income of the money Fanny had settled on him from their earlier tour back in happier days. Although her two brothers were struggling in their careers in academia and the army, respectively, her younger sister, Adelaide, had become a famous opera singer. Indeed, the Kemble name still worked like magic in the theater world, and Fanny soon found work performing Shakespeare again, first at provincial theaters, then back in London at Covent Garden, and then at the Princess Theater, co-starring with the most famous leading man of his day, William Charles Macready. Now, she felt keenly how much her neglected acting skills had grown rusty, and how much her older body little suited some of her former roles. But the fees she earned were gratifyingly large. True, the work with Macready she found extremely trying, because he was famously, openly judgmental about his fellow actors on stage, and he tended to hiss and carpet them from under his breath during scenes together. And in his private diaries, he acidly remarked that Fanny was essentially untrained, and to his mind, shockingly amateurish. "I have never seen a Desdemona so bad, so unnatural, so affected, so conceited," Macready fumed. There was not only the insults of her co-stars, but other issues she had always hated about the stage. Paying for her own costumes and for her own dressers and for the accommodations and for dealing with the constant appraisal of her body. But soon Fanny found herself engaged in a much better, to her mind, an even more lucrative career. Her father had been giving readings in lecture halls of the works of Shakespeare from his own edited versions of the Bard's complete works. He could earn £20 or more from a single performance. All he had to do was show up with a book, and audiences would flock to hear him. But increasingly, Charles Kemble was growing deaf and could not hear the audience or himself. So he happily turned over that side of the family business to his daughter. And with just 3 or 4 bookings a week, traveling about the country, visiting lecture rooms and concert halls, Fanny found she could make quite a respectable living and even start to save again, longing for the day when she could be reunited with her daughters once they came of age. And as she angrily noted to her friends, she was not even sure that Pierce was giving them her letters. She published articles, books, and poetry as well when she could, but her journal about her time in Georgia she dared not print, lest Pierce punish her for it in some way. But Fanny Kemble had at last found the work of her life. Her rich and resonant voice filled the largest rooms again. She would make her entrance simply, sit down at a little desk with her text and a reading lamp, arrange her skirts, and begin. She read some poems and short pieces, but principally she read the entire plays of Shakespeare. No longer confined to just embodying the female roles, she read every part in the play. She could be Hamlet, Romeo, Macbeth, King Lear. She could be Oberon and Titania, Othello and Desdemona, Prince Hal and Falstaff. And audiences flocked to hear her, a greater number of people than had ever seen her on the stage, because in that era, again, many people were still unwilling to enter a theater because of their religious beliefs or moral scruples. But a lecture hall, well, now, that was something different. That was something uplifting and edifying. And for her, it was deeply satisfying work.
For more than 20 years as a wandering rhapsodist, I never consciously sacrificed my sense of what was due my work. To my own profound feeling of the sense of these noble works, I owed whatever power I found to interpret them. My greatest reward has been passing a large portion of my life in familiar intercourse with the greatest and the best English mind and heart, living almost daily in that world into which he lifted me.
It's true that she was reading somewhat expurgated versions of Shakespeare's texts, and her performance never lasted more than 2 hours. But she did not shrink from offering to her audience even the more obscure Shakespeare plays, such as Cymbeline or the ones previously considered problematic to perform, like The Tempest. She did not condescend to her audiences. In response to a Boston friend who had asked her by letter for a version of Measure for Measure that was edited down so as to be readable by schoolgirls, Fanny wrote back,
"My dear Mary, the story of Measure for Measure is incorrigible, and though I read the play because it is full of fine things, and also the best version of the text, 'Let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall,' is not suitable for babes, but strong meat for men. Shakespeare's plays were written neither for women nor for children."
By 1847, Pierce Butler finally agreed to a divorce. And although he had threatened Fanny again and again with a full trial, in the end, her lawyers, including Charles Sumner and her powerful friends, the Sedgwicks, made him finally agree to a settlement with what he considered his disobedient and fractious wife. Although typically he was never to really honor his promise of regular payments to her, she did not care anymore, for she no longer really needed them. She began to tour America, at least the Northeast and Midwest, where she was welcome, but not the South, where she was not. in the same way that she had toured England. In November of 1849, she played Philadelphia again for the first time in 15 years. She read King Lear to a packed room at the Sansom Street Hall, a public lecture room right near Independence Hall. The 14-year-old red-headed son of Fanny's friend, the Unitarian minister William Furness, came to hear her read, an experience that made the young man a lifelong addict of the bard. Later, of course, Professor Henry Howard Furness, as he would become, was one of the most eminent Shakespeare scholars in America, a distinguished professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and the editor of the Variorum Shakespeare. In future years, he would also receive one of Fanny's most prized possessions, a 16th-century leather glove that her father had been given by the actor David Garrick, who claimed in turn that it had been made in the shop of John Shakespeare in Stratford-on-Avon, perhaps worked upon by young Will Shakespeare himself. Though she never was to settle completely in one spot ever again in life, Fanny was able to travel between Europe and America for the next 30 years. She bought a house in Lenox, Massachusetts, near her dear friends, the Sedgwicks, and when her daughters reached the age of 21, she was able to meet with them once again freely. True, both of her girls retained significant attachment to their father, especially the younger one, Frances. The older daughter, Sarah, married Dr. Owen Wister, one of their neighbors from Germantown, and she was able to settle down at Butler Place to raise a family, as her parents had once tried to do. Fortunately, the property was separated from their father's control before he lost all of his money by speculating in stocks before the Great Panic of 1857, a calamity that led him to finally do the one thing the Butlers had always sworn they would never do. In an enormous and ghastly auction in 1859 near Atlanta, hundreds of Butler slaves were sold off to pay his debts. Pierce Butler tried to keep families together, he claimed, and he solemnly pressed shiny new quarters into their hands as they went off with their new owners. The tight-knit community on Butler Island was forever shattered, though with the outbreak of the Civil War 2 years later, monumental change was coming anyway, as we know now, but they, of course, did not yet. Fanny herself spent most of the Civil War period living in Germantown as a guest of her son-in-law in her old home. Fortunately, Dr. Wister doted upon Fanny, sometimes much to Sarah's annoyance. Pierce Butler, for his part, was arrested by the U.S. government as a suspected Southern sympathizer and a spy, and he stayed in jail for a long period, which we can all enjoy. His former plantations on the Sea Islands became a magnet for black people fleeing the Confederacy, and they were occupied by Union soldiers. Indeed, the famous 54th Massachusetts Regiment of African-American soldiers was quartered there for a time. Their leader, Colonel Robert Gould Shaw, who was the son of friends of Fanny's and had known her as a boy in Boston, was able to convey to her, by letter, greetings from some of the former Butler slaves who remembered her fondly, it seemed. Sadly, however, Colonel Shaw and many of his men were soon thereafter killed in the attack on nearby Fort Wagner outside Charleston, the news of which caused Fanny considerable sadness and distress. During the war, Fanny continued her readings and often dedicated the earnings to charitable causes supporting the Union. But her most profound action during this time was finally releasing to the general public her long-held memoirs of her time in the South, published in 1863, both in England and in America, under the title Journal of a Residence on a Georgia Plantation. It received glowing reviews in the British and the Northern press, and although we know today that there exist many other first-person narratives of American slavery, indeed, most importantly, from former slaves themselves, Fanny Kemble, in that time, was already known as a public figure. She was a celebrity. And so, seeing her searing eyewitness depiction of Southern slavery coming out so soon after Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, well, it was regarded by many as a confirmation of the justice of the Union cause. It was a sort of why we fight, shoring up the moral basis for continued effort to utterly rid America of the stain of its original sin at a time when it seemed like the war would never end. And there were some in the North urging compromise and settlement in the wake of Southern victories. The American edition of the book came out in June of 1863, and so was widely distributed and read in the wake of the Battle of Gettysburg in early July that year. Lengthy reviews by abolitionists such as Frederick Law Olmsted and Horace Greeley added to its reputation. It was reportedly read aloud to assemblies of working men in England, whose factories were idled by the dearth of Southern cotton in that period, and it may have strengthened the British public's resolve never to actually recognize the Confederacy. Although many have argued that the book's greatest impact came in the 20th century, as writers and historians eagerly mined it for vivid details, it more than anything else served to burnish Fanny Kemble's historical reputation. It has lasted longer in the national memory, more than any performance she ever gave. Even though the book begins with a clear-eyed description of how unjustly even free black people were typically treated on the streets of northern cities, such as Philadelphia, it was her forceful denunciation of the physical, psychological, and moral cruelty of American chattel slavery in the South that made its reputation. In the South, in particular, some people bristle to this day at Fanny's blistering denunciations of how white men had children with the women that they held in bondage, and how white women gave their own children to black women to suckle from the very bodies they supposedly so disdained. It was rough stuff. Fanny's own daughter, Frances, would one day return to the property, which stayed in the family's possession for many decades, and write her own refutation of it. Even Fanny's grandson, the writer Owen Wister, would later pen a novel that defended the moral principles of Southern planters. Well, after the Civil War was over, Fanny Kemble had largely turned away from both the private and public battles that had so consumed much of her life. After a final series of readings in Philadelphia and elsewhere in 1869, she largely retired, giving in to the issues of her aging body, but not before receiving a final encomium from the Philadelphia Press, which in former years had not always known what to make of this brash and difficult Englishwoman. In her final years in the public eye, she was now a great person. In May of 1869, the Philadelphia Inquirer wrote a glowing tribute announcing her final appearance at the Academy of Music, reading Shakespeare's As You Like It, in a benefit performance for the Mercantile Library. Quote, "This gifted elocutionist and most estimable lady will give one of her inimitable readings on Wednesday. Those who attend may confidently count upon an evening of unalloyed intellectual enjoyment." Close quotes. Fanny stayed in Philadelphia up through the Centennial Exposition of 1876, and when she found it difficult to walk through the enormous fairgrounds, her daughter Sarah pushed her in a wheelchair. Typically, she compared it unfavorably with the grander exhibition she had once seen in London, but she allowed that she was very excited by the steam engines of Machinery Hall. She was looking forward, actually, to returning to England at last in her final years, her finances now firmly anchored by the hefty earnings of her reading tours. Her other daughter, Frances, had married an English clergyman. Indeed, he was posted for a good while at Stratford-upon-Avon, which allowed Fanny to make frequent visits to the bard's birthplace and to his grave. Interestingly, in her final years, she spent a lot of her time writing even more memoirs, more poems, and even her first novel. It was the literary life she had always wanted. She even became a close friend of the American expatriate writer Henry James, and once told him a story from Kemble Family History about her ne'er-do-well brother Henry, which James eventually used as the basis for his novel Washington Square, and so, which eventually became the play and the movie entitled The Heiress, another legacy of Fanny's. She lived on in London until her death in 1893. But, as we often ask ourselves on this podcast, what remains? Theatrical lives are so ephemeral. Well, as the memories of Fanny Kemble faded, Thomas Sully's stunning portraits of her still glowed on the walls of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts and at the Rosenbach Museum. And I think that glove that she gave to Henry Furness is still here in the library at the University of Pennsylvania. But there's another monument to Fanny Kemble in Philadelphia I'd like to mention, one that's more obscure, but perhaps more meaningful. There's a delightful triangle of greenery and open space, part of the Fairmount Park network, in the Germantown Olney area of Philadelphia. It's named Kemble Park. It's part of the former Butler Place Estates. It sits close by to the campus of LaSalle University in Northwest Philadelphia. It nearby is Wister Wood and also Einstein Medical Center and Central High School. At the corner of Olney Avenue and North 16th Street, across from a row of neat homes, is set a large stone at the corner of the park with a brass plaque. Fanny Kemble Abolitionist Memorial Park, it reads. Named in honor of Fanny Ann Kemble, abolitionist, Shakespearean actress, poet. And to me, that seems as fitting a tribute as she could ever have wished for. I'm Peter Schmitz, and the sound and the music are by Christopher Mark Colucci. The voice of Fanny Kemble was performed by Jessica Bedford. As always, there are additional images, blog posts, and bibliographies about this episode and all others on our website, www.aithpodcast.com. Look there for information about our upcoming walking tour. Thanks for coming along on another adventure in theater history, Philadelphia.